The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
A brief note. Cezanne begins his talk by lying on the floor, perpendicular to the sangha, with his hands in gachot, and quotes a passage from the play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard.
Good morning. My name is Cezanne, also known as Bill Ewing, and welcome to the Village Zendo Sunday morning practice. A couple of periods of Zazen with Ken Hin, an opportunity to do interview, and a Dharma talk. It's nice to see all of you here on this really beautiful, crisp fall morning. And some of you I recognize and a few people I don't. It's nice to see some longtime friends and practitioners here that I've enjoyed my practice with. And welcome to all the new people who I don't quite know yet. And welcome also to everyone who's listening to this on a electronic device. Do you ever think about yourself as actually dead? Lying in a box with a lid on it? No? I don't either, really. I mean, it's silly to be depressed by it. It's like thinking of yourself alive in a box. You just keep forgetting that you're actually dead, and that should make all the difference, shouldn't it? I mean, you wouldn't know you were in a box. It's like being asleep in a box. Not that I'd want to sleep in a box, mind you. Not without any air in it. You'd wake up with a start, and then where would you be? In a box. That's the bit I don't like about it. That's, frankly, why I don't think about it. I mean, I guess you'd be helpless stuffed in a box like that. Not to mention the fact that you're dead and you'd be in there forever. It's not a pretty thought, especially if you're dead. I mean, ask yourself, if I were to ask you right out, I'm going to stuff you in this box, would you rather be alive or dead? Naturally, you'd rather be alive. You'd prefer that. I mean, at least you'd have a chance. Life in a box is better than no life at all. I mean, you could lie there thinking, at least I'm not dead. Pretty soon somebody's going to come around and bang on the lid and tell me to get out. Hey, you in there, what's your name? Get out of there. They probably just want to kill me. I guess that's why I don't think about it. And if I were you, I wouldn't think about it either. You'll probably just get depressed. Whatever happened to that moment when you first understood about death? Just that moment in childhood when it occurred to you that you won't go on forever. It must have been shattering, stamped into my memory. And yet, I don't remember it. The thought never occurred to me at all. We must be born with an intuition of mortality, even before we knew what the word was, even before we knew there were words. Out we come, bloodied and squalling, with the knowledge that for all the points of the compass, there is only one direction, and time is its only measure. That's a short speech from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, a play by Tom Stoppard. What I want to talk about today is what that speech talks about, death. And I think it exemplifies in the front that it's our brain trying to comprehend death as an experience is sort of futile and kind of funny. I mean, we can't experience death and we can't try to understand it as an experience until we're going through it. What we experience of death is usually through the death of another person. And depending on how close that person is to us, how intimate we are with them, and what our feelings and emotions are around them, the experience of their death can be very shattering. I like the phrase intuition of mortality. Intuition is that kind of knowing something before you know it, feeling it, having a sense of it before your brain or even your heart has come to understand what that sense is or what it is. And the word mortality has a way of including life and death in it. It's not just that crisp death and that's it. It's life and death. And in truth, what I really want to talk about is I want to talk about how my practice at this point in my life has helped me to deal with that. About 3 years ago, I was on the phone with my sister at this time of year, right around Thanksgiving, and she told me that she had had 3 minor heart attacks. She lives in Brunswick, Georgia, and I live in New York. And I was kind of shocked when she said it, and I said, because she said it in this very kind of castaway, thrown away kind of minor heart attacks. And I said, what do you mean minor? Did you go to the hospital? And she said, yes. I was in the hospital. And I said, then they're not minor. Well, that's the way my doctor talked about it. Her doctor probably deals with death or mortality a little more frequently than she really wanted to think about at that point. I was shocked. And after that conversation, because my sister and I weren't talking that frequently, a couple of times a year, but for a while prior to that, we had kind of estranged ourselves. We didn't speak for several years, and over other emotions. But that year at the winter session, it really occurred to me that my sister is going to die before I am, and it's probably going to be sooner than it is later, and I need to see her. I need to talk with her face to face, not over the phone. Her hearing was getting very bad, and our telephone conversations, half of which had to be interpreted by her husband who had the phone. The hearing devices weren't any good for her, and he would relay the question, she would answer, and he would tell me. So for the next 6 months, I needed to devise a way to get to see my sister, which was not easy. But a friend of mine from Atlanta, who comes to visit me frequently, used his frequent flyer miles to buy me a ticket. He was happy to host me for a little while in Atlanta and pay for the flight down to Brunswick, Georgia on the coast and visit with my sister, as long as I promised to come back and visit with him for a while on the return trip. So that was taken care of. It was just a matter of getting my mind and my heart set in a way that I could say what I needed to say and hear what I needed to hear from her. And I'm here to tell you that I went over that conversation almost on a daily basis for a couple of months while sitting on the cushion. I mean, yeah, I was working on koans, and yeah, there were other things going on in my life, but this is what kept coming back to my thoughts. And so I've learned my mind is way too stubborn, so I might as well just sit with it. I went over that conversation, our conversations, what I thought would happen, over and over and over. The script, what I would say, what she would respond. And I was very, very careful before the first 2 weeks in June when I was going to take this a couple of months later, especially the 2 weeks before, to set aside everything that I had thought, every script that I had written, every story that this overwrought brain of mine created around that situation. And I set them all aside, because I wanted this to be what it was, not what I think it should be or what I thought it was going to be, but just what it was. And I kind of prepared myself in that way, sort of clean the slate, which was part of what I wanted to do with her in our conversations. And I can tell you that that trip and the time that I spent with her was as awkward as our meeting in the airport. We passed and we didn't recognize each other. She was in a wheelchair and I had kind of white hair, which, and a little bit of a beard, which she had never seen before. I mean, she had, but it was much earlier and it was a different color. So, and I wasn't used to seeing her in a wheelchair. And we did, the airport there is very small. It's hard to miss somebody. So, you know, on the way back, you know, we meet and laugh. And I spent the week with her. It happened to be the week of their anniversary, which was the first week in June. She had been married for many years. And I had a good time there. The only thing that I brought with me that I thought might help are the poems that I've read and a couple of my koans. And I got up every morning early and meditated. And basically, I had several opportunities to talk with my sister without her husband or a grown son who lives with them, staying, you know, there, that we could actually be alone and not be disturbed. And parts of the conversation were awkward. I could tell when I was talking about something that she either didn't want to talk about or wasn't really listening to. She had that convenient space of being kind of like, I didn't hear that, because her hearing was not real good. And we had to sit kind of close so that she could hear me. And that made it more intimate in another way, which I was completely comfortable with, and she was too. Suffice it to say, I got to most of what I wanted to say, and I hope I feel good that I left her with enough room for her to say what she needed to say for me. And the hardest part was, again, at the airport, you know, that last look, because I had that intuition of mortality. It was like, this will be the last time I see her. She may not die in the next 10 years, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to travel like this frequently. And my intuition was correct. I got back here and I went to the summer Ongo that year. It was 2016. And it was wonderful. The practice here supported a lot of the feelings that I had around that. And when I was at summer Ongo, I had the joy and the pleasure to be asked to be the Eno for the middle 2 weeks, the Jukai and the arts practice weeks. And it was the year that we started having orioki for all three meals, which I love orioki. having the pleasure to eat in silence with members in the Sangha is just wonderful. And I felt very honored that I could handle being Eno for that period of time. My life kind of went on as usual. And the next year, I mean, I was, by that I mean with my, about my sister, we had fallen into the habit of speaking a couple of times before Easter and having a few phone conversations before Christmas, before the holidays. One of the things I did talk about on that trip, which was a good intro, is I decided that I wanted to be cremated, that I would not be buried in the family plot, which is in a cemetery, a beautiful cemetery in Atlanta. And that already has my father's mother and father, my father and mother. And there are three other spaces there for myself, my sister, and my brother. And my brother has already decided that he wanted to be buried with his wife, who died several years earlier. And so there were two empty, I mean, if I was going to be cremated, which I had made the decision, there would be two empty plots there. So I had an opportunity to offer them through my brother and having the papers ready that if they wanted those plots, they could be signed over to them. And they weren't sure. And I let them know that I was going to be cremated, that I wouldn't be using mine. My brother isn't going to be using his. So that was part of our conversation. Didn't last very long. I don't think my brother-in-law likes talking about anything around that. It's like he doesn't like hospitals and death. So I came to the summer Ongo the next year, 2017. And again, I was asked to be the Eno for the middle 2 weeks. And I love doing that service. I love the liturgy here. The practice, the intensive sitting, the amount of sitting is wonderful. The schedule for me at this point is very easy. And before I left, my brother-in-law called to tell me that my sister had gone into the hospital. She was having some problems getting enough oxygen. She was very sedentary, so she was doing a lot of OT and PT, a lot of physical therapy and occupational therapy. She needed to do more exercise to get enough blood back into her system. Ungo had started, and when I talked to my brother, my brother-in-law the next time, he had said that their first daughter, their first child, had very unexpectedly died, my niece, my sister's first daughter, her only daughter. She was a grown woman and had sons and family around her that took care of everything. My brother-in-law wouldn't be able to go to his daughter's funeral because he was busy taking care of my sister. And I understood that. I could not afford to come down there to do that. And then 2 weeks later, my sister died. She was still, she was in the treatment center, you know, doing the physical therapy, and it just, they weren't able to go to the funeral, to her daughter's funeral, and I could imagine in my head that she just declined, became more still. It was very disturbing to me. And at the same time, I was glad that I was at the retreat. What happens here when we meditate, a container is made that will hold everything. And I have to say, it held my life beautifully. I felt safe to have all of my feelings. The Dharma talks were gorgeous. We were studying the Bindoa, the Ginjo Koan, and there's a paragraph about firewood and ash, which of course relates to death, and it's about how the ash will never become firewood again. And that helped me immensely, just in terms of how I think about someone's death. And 2 days after, for the 2 days after she died, I was still doing Eno and in the morning meditating and sitting. The two cushions next to me were empty because the Tenzo's assistant had kind of dropped out for several days. So the people that were sitting on those two cushions were in the kitchen and working on our orioki, and that cushion was empty. And of course, I was thinking about my sister for those 2 days or 2 or 3 days, for a while after that. And I was feeling very sad, and I got the sense that my sister was kind of hovering around. I mean, literally hovering around me in that environment. And she was asking questions like, why is everybody dressed in black? They didn't die. and she was also, why is everybody so quiet? Nobody's saying anything. Everybody's quiet, even when they're not sitting here, you know? And it's like, I just thought, okay, if you're going to do this up here, I'm just going to ask you to sit down next to me and let me explain what's happening. And so I described what my day is like and what the sitting is like to my sister, which was not something that when she was alive was particularly interested in. And I explained it to her, and this was during the third period of the morning sit, and I said, in a few minutes, someone's going to start tolling that bell, and we're all going to get up and file into the room right here, and we're going to chant, and we're going to chant the Heart Sutra. And it's a really beautiful sutra. And if you pay attention to the words, it will explain a lot of why I do this, why I sit, and why I sit with these people. And then the second part of the service is about the people who are sick, and we dedicate it to them and to their healing, and to the people who are around them helping that healing. And the third part is dedicated to our ancestors. And listen carefully for that part, because your name will come up. And sure enough, the bell started ringing. We went in, and I was focusing my mind just on the Heart Sutra and chanting. And as much as I can focus my mind these days, it's been hard for me to memorize the dedications. Some of them are long, and we also chant the names of our ancestors, the women ancestors and the men ancestors. And I explained that to her as well, but she'd hear that later in the day. But I was really honored to have Riatan stand next to me and hold the book so he could prompt me if I forgot anything. And he also read some of the dedications. So we get to the end of the third chant, where we dedicate this to our ancestors. And the first line of that dedication is, Buddha turns the Dharma wheel, and so reality is shown in all its many forms. All suffering sentient beings are liberated and come to great joy. And at that point, right in the middle of that last part of the line, my voice cracked, because I realized that my sister's suffering has ended. She won't suffer anymore. And I could celebrate her life for the joy that's in it, for the joy that it brought me, for the joy and that I thanked her for when I had my last opportunity to talk to her, that she had brought into my life. The rest of the ongo was like glass until I was asked to do the chanting of the Heart Sutra for the Shuso Hosen, which is done very slow, and it's hard for me to get that. But I had very large print, and it was easy to do. And I really felt held in all of my activities there. The next thing I want to talk about is, I feel like I had mourned my sister appropriately. And in the fall of last year at this time, I started feeling very sluggish. And around in November, I started feeling like, I don't want to get up. I don't want to go out. I don't want to go practice. I still went out. I made myself come in the mornings. And I was part of the PATH class that year, and I was still here doing my practice, but my life began to feel very flat. I didn't feel really engaged. I didn't feel like I was growing mentally, spiritually. I was not really engaging myself and everything into my life. And then it came to me just before the winter ongo, the winter retreat, that I'm becoming depressed, and I couldn't figure out what it was about. I thought about it, and I decided that I needed some help. So I got in touch with a therapist that I had done therapy with previously and who had helped me with some depression. And as quick as I could get to it, which would be in the new year, it was March, it was the 1st of March when I finally made around to making the appointment. In the meantime, the friend who had bought the tickets for me with his air miles, he died the last day of February. And I was in the midst of grieving his death. And when I started doing the 5 or 6 sessions of therapy with my therapist, I realized that I was holding on to my grief. And then until I had mourned for my sister, I had gone through a lot of my feelings, but there was a lot of stuff there. And my friend's death reminded me of that because he knew my sister, and he and my sister witnessed the early part of my life. Well, I decided in January, yes, I'm going to do this therapy, but this feeling of being still is not going away, and it really bothered me. So I decided it didn't fit with my belief of impermanence, that everything is changing. So I decided at that time that I would just let my beard grow, that I might shave the sides, but I would just let it grow, and that would be a daily reminder as it got longer that I was changing even if I didn't feel like it, and that I can change and that things will change. And that indeed prompted me to eventually make the appointments with my therapist and made me realize, as my daily sitting did when thoughts of my sister came back to me, that there was part of the grieving, a deeper kind of mourning that I hadn't gotten to. So I had to open that shell that's around my heart, you know, and open up to all of my feelings. And some of them were quite deep. I mean, to the point that when I was in line at Starbucks one morning, there was some music on, and I ordered my usual coffee, and as I was at the condiment station stirring, I was just overwhelmed with sadness. And I was trying to think, what is it? Why do I feel so sad? And I realized that the music that was playing was a remake of a song that I associated with my sister. And I was just, I like just kind of came apart. And it was like, it's okay, you can cry in Starbucks. You're just having a feeling. It will change. I got my sunglasses out, you know, and sat down with the coffee and stared out the window and just grieved. And just grieved. What I do when I sit on this cushion is I open my mind and my heart to what the reality of my life is. And how it comes out sometimes in the strangest things at the strangest times, but it's my life and I can have it. The first part of that dedication, that last dedication, says, Buddha turns the Dharma wheel, and so reality is shown in all its many forms. And for myself, I have come to understand that as Buddha, who is the awakened one, the one who has come to conscience and has decided to spread that through a kind of practice in meditation, to spread that raised consciousness, is our raised consciousness is what turns the wheel of life, which is full of Dharma. It's full of the cause and effect, the absolute, the relative, life and death, and that it's all there. And that when I practice, when I raise my consciousness as Buddha and Dogen and many of the people after him and many of the women after him and women in my life now have told me, you know, it's right here. We get that through our practice. We raise our consciousness just by sitting, by being one with all of that. My depression lifted, And I decided at that point that I would put a blue streak in my beard, which some of you probably saw. I have a friend who does a lot of meditation in another tradition. And she was looking very enviously at my beard. She's a hair colorist, and she's known for, in the city, in the salons, as being a really excellent hair colorist. And she's a wonderfully sweet woman. And she took care of that for me. So for a long time, until it faded, and until just recently when I trimmed my beard, I had this blue streak. And it reminded me that, you know, life is not about just being blue, that it also includes the joy. To close my Dharma talk, I'm going to recite for you, I'm not going to chant, I'm going to recite for you the evening gatha, which was the first piece of liturgy that came to me and that moved me. And I think it was maybe the third or fourth time I came to sit in the evening. And that evening gatha says, let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by, and opportunity is lost. Each of us should strive to awaken. Awaken! Take heed. Do not squander your life.